This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. An avid mountain climber, she was 50 years old and looking for a new challenge. She set her sights on making a solo journey to the Earth's magnetic North Pole. She was the first woman to do it and the first American to do it. Helen Thayer and a dog named Charlie trekked 345 miles over 27 days to reach the pole in 1988. 4 years later, she and her husband Bill became the first and oldest married couple to reach the pole on foot without being resupplied. In 1996, she became the first woman to walk across the Sahara Desert, following an ancient 2,400-mile camel trade route. Explorer Helen Thayer celebrated her 60th birthday in the Antarctic. There, she covered more than 450 miles and pulled a 260-pound sled. In 2001, she and her husband Bill traveled 1,500 miles across the Gobi Desert. What's next? Next year, Helen and Bill Thayer are planning to walk across Tibet, Bhutan, and Sikkim. Helen Thayer is our guest this afternoon, and listeners, I invite your questions and comments for her. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, you can use our toll-free line. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. A native of New Zealand, Helen Thayer is a former discus thrower, sled racer, and in 1975 was the U.S. National Luge Champion. In 2002, the National Geographic Society named her one of the greatest explorers of the 20th century. She's also the author of Polar Dream, Three Among the Wolves, and the forthcoming Walking the Gobi. And she is one of the women featured in the new book, Women Explorers, in the Women Who Dare series from the Library of Congress. This book, Women Explorers, is published by Pomegranate, and it is authored by Sharon Hannon. You'll find our guest, Helen Thayer, on the web at www.helenthayer.com. Again, those phone numbers, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Helen Thayer, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you for joining us this afternoon. Pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
When and how did your interest in mountain climbing begin?
I began climbing mountains when I was 9 years old in New Zealand. And my parents, whose hobby was to climb mountains, finally allowed me to go as long as I could carry my own pack. So we climbed Mount Taranaki. It's just about 8,500 feet high, and it was snow and ice all the way to the top because it was in the middle of winter. And so that was my first real taste of taking on something that was just a little bit bigger than I was.
Yeah.
And then that made me decide right then, even though I was only nine, that was the life that I wanted to lead.
Yeah. It sounds like your parents had played a big role in your love of the outdoors.
Yes, they were definitely role models throughout and still are throughout my life. They were very good at goal setting and planning, getting things done, disciplined, and of course they expected all of that of me too. So I had good training, I had good role models, and Sir Edmund Hillary, the first person to summit Mount Everest, was also a family friend. And, of course, he's an absolutely wonderful person, and he was a childhood mentor.
Yeah, and he wrote the foreword to Polar Dream.
That's right, he did,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Among the things that the words that I would use to describe you, explorer, author, athlete, and teacher, your website has a number of resources for classroom teachers in the area of the site called Adventure Classroom. And one of the objectives of these lessons is to instill in children the idea that they can set goals and with some planning, they can achieve them. When did teaching become an important part of who you are?
Well, I was standing on top of peak communism in Tajikistan in 1986. It's about 25,000 feet high. And it was then, as I looked on one side into China and south into Afghanistan and west into Tajikistan, I decided then that I needed to share my experiences and what I was seeing with students, and especially those people who may never be able to go to these places. So I, as I climbed down the mountain back down to base camp with the team, I was on a climbing team, I decided on the name Adventure Classroom, and I decided it would be students K through 12 that I would target. And that's when I decided to go to the magnetic North Pole alone so that I could learn about those polar bears I knew that I'd have to live with, and about the magnetic North Pole, which has a lot of scientific significance in the world of navigation. And of course, learn about the Inuit people who inhabit the villages around the edge of the pole area. No one actually lives at the magnetic North Pole, never will. It's way too far north, too severe. But it was such a tremendous opportunity to learn and pass on information. That's when my appetite really grew for teaching, just to pass on anything that I could from my experiences.
Mm, wonderful stories. What is the magnetic North Pole? It's different than the North Pole.
Well, there are four major poles in the world. The two geographic poles, the geographic north and the geographic south pole, that's where all the lines of longitude meet at the very top of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it might, due to the Earth's sort of wobble, it moves about 60 feet a year, is about all. But the magnetic North Pole is a very alive entity. This is where our magnetic compass needles point to. This is what we use in navigation in the air, on sea, and land. And so, and this pole moves around. It actually moves. It can move 50 miles in a day in elliptical fashion, around and around it goes. And so you go into the vicinity, into the center of this area of the magnetic North Pole, and then it slowly advances north. Right now it's advancing northwest. And so it's a very, very interesting study.
Where was it in 1988?
In 1988, it was south of a place called King Christian Island. And because I was, this is 1988, even though it's not that long ago, things were very different then than what they are now. I was using the last of the experimental GPS units. It was running on alkaline batteries, which you had to say a very long prayer before you ever turned the thing on, in case the cold killed its memory. And so I was able to use that. But in order to be sure of my navigation, I traveled 30 miles north of the pole in order to find the northern coast of King Christian Island. Once I established that, then I backtracked back down to where the coordinate numbers, the latitude and longitude of the magnetic North Pole. And so, but now, of course, it's easy. When I was in the Antarctic, in fact, I had two very small GPS units, one in each pocket, one as a backup, and they run on lithium batteries. And navigation, for one thing, navigation is so much easier now than what I had. It was really, you can't use a magnetic compass going to the magnetic North Pole, so I had to use Eskimo or Inuit methods, and I had to use my watch as a type of compass and all sorts of methods, the groove in the ice to tell the north and south because of the prevailing winds and all these things that the Inuit had used for many years.
Mm. That's really impressive, and it's also impressive to think about the explorers that have gone before those who are in the field today.
Oh, yes. The women, these historical explorers, they really paved the way for people like me, just as people like me are paving the way for future generations. We each build on previous generations. And, of course, these women were really very amazing because they had difficulties we don't have to face now, such as was socially unacceptable for a young lady to step out and explore the world, go into dangerous places, and my goodness, to go alone would be unheard of. And so they had social stigma to put up with, and those long dresses. As I was walking across the Gobi Desert, it was a 1,600-mile journey, and it was 2001. I can remember, it was on about day 70, I remarked, it was an 81-day journey, and I remarked to my husband, how in the world did those women in the old days get across places with those, because these long dresses, because no one had walked they hadn't walked across the entire length of the Gobi Desert. I can see why you'd never make it at 126 degrees in those long dresses and, of course, their bonnets. And it was just very, very different.
Yeah. On the front cover of Women Explorers, there is a photograph of Harriet Chalmers Adams in the Gobi Desert in Mongolia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. She is decked out in this coat that, you know, is... It's got to be a skirt underneath there.
Yes, completely covered. And of course, she rode camels and rode in a kind of a wagon as well. But even so, you can imagine what the boots must have been like. And how in the world she, of course, one thing that does tell me by that photo, she was there in the wintertime, mm-hmm. or at least in, she wasn't there in the summer, because the camel has got a full coat of wool on him. The camels, these are the Bactrian camels, and they're shorn for in the springtime to ready them for the summer heat. In the wintertime, they have these beautiful long coats.
Yeah, it's a magnificent animal.
Yes, it really is. They're an amazing animal. And but these people that went out there and did these sorts of things. In 1988, I had a little bit of stigma to get through. I looked for corporate sponsorship for my expedition, and even though I was a highly experienced high-altitude mountain climber and international athlete, corporate America just laughed at me. They said, you're 50 years old, you're a woman, and you're going alone. It's ridiculous. You'll never make it. And it was just so much stigma attached. And I thought, this is 1988. These people are just, you know, they haven't really caught up with the times, it seemed to me. So my husband, who's a helicopter pilot, said, look, I'll fly the helicopter and I'll support it financially. You go do it. So off I went. And fortunately for me, I have a most wonderful husband. We've been married 46 years now,
yeah.
But he's so supportive, and of course he's very good at expeditions himself. But I had that problem to some degree then, and so I can understand a little bit about what these ladies went through in times much earlier than mine.
Do you think being told there's no way you can do it just makes you all the more determined?
Well, for me, I don't believe in going out. If you say, oh, you can't do that, I don't believe in, so, well, I'll show you. I don't like to do that, because that's a good way to get killed in these dangerous places we go into. But what it does for me is I realize that, you know, there are people who just don't get it. And I don't allow them to interfere with my ambition or my goals or my plans. I just don't allow that, because... if you do, well, you just basically sit in your rocking chair and do nothing. I'm 69 years old, and I've had people tell me, you're way too old to do these things. Well, I'm 69 going on 25. And one lady told me this a while ago, and I said, you know, you and I should join up as a team. You can stay home and worry about how old I am, and I'll go away and do the expeditions, and then it'll save me all that trouble of caring about how old I am. And she got my point, and she could see what I was talking about.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about Harriet Chalmers Adams. We brought up her name. She was born in 1875 and lived until 1937. She died in 1937. She was the most prolific woman to ever write for the National Geographic. She was a war correspondent for Harper's Magazine during World War I, and she visited the front lines in France as a correspondent. I can, you know, as you mentioned, you can only imagine what she had to get past in order to do what she, you know, what she was able to accomplish in her life.
Oh, yes. You can imagine being up on the front lines, and you can imagine just the comments. Certain amount of rudeness would go on around her, and she would have to turn a deaf ear and a blind eye to a lot of things. And just being a woman there, but also being looked down upon because she was a woman, and leading a, you know, obviously a very different life to what she was leading at home. So it's just really hard for those of us in this day and age to really understand what someone like that would really go through.
Yeah. One of the things that she's quoted as saying here in this article about her in Women Explorers is, she says, we all have a Mecca, Since childhood, I had journeyed in my dreams. What was your first Mecca? Was it that mountain in New Zealand when you were 9 years old?
Yes, even before then, I can remember as long as I can remember looking at those mountains and just being absolutely inspired by them. Even as a five-year-old, I would look at those mountains and couldn't take my eyes off them. I could see myself climbing those mountains, and some of my earliest reading was about mountain climbers and about the outdoor, and I'd talk about it and dream about it and think about it. And then when I climbed that mountain, of course, then I had the experience of struggling for something that was difficult because I was only 9 years old. My nine-year-old legs had a tough time getting up that very difficult mountain. It was difficult for me then. And so once I got that taste, then I could just see myself doing these things and I just yearned to go do them. It was a passion and something that I dreamt about and talked about and just yearned for.
Yeah. Were stories of explorers important to you when you were a girl and a young woman?
Well, I read, of course, everything I could about Sir Edmund Hillary, or Ed as we called him. But I didn't have many in the way of women role models. There were no, except for these ladies in the far-off, more distant history. But in my time, there were no women out there really on the front lines doing expeditions and exploring. It was all men, really. And so I grew up in an era when it was men that I read about, and men that I heard about, and men that I looked up to in this field. And then, of course, as I stepped out, I found myself doing. I climbed Mount Cook at age 18, and I'm the youngest woman to have ever climbed the mountain, and so forth. But then it was something that wasn't even then not quite acceptable for a young lady to be dashing about in such a fashion.
Hmm. Well, I was born in the 1950s, and as a young girl, these stories, I wouldn't have known these stories of the women that are collected in Women Explorers either.
No, it's something we didn't hear about, but now, thanks to these publishers and the Library of Congress, we're hearing about these women now, and that's why I think this series of books belongs in every school library. Girls should have access to these books, and they should read about these people. And understand, as I go into schools now, I've spoken to over a million kids actually in schools, in person in schools, and I tell them, you girls have got the same opportunity as boys, both boys and girls. We're on the level playing field now. And think about what those people did before we came along. They set the stage for us. If it wasn't for them, we probably wouldn't be doing what we're doing now.
Hmm. You've accomplished so much. How do you go about setting a new challenge for yourself?
Oh, it's not hard. There's so many challenges in this world. Basically, it all depends on how far you want to push your horizons. I push mine to infinity. Some people have them sort of sitting on the end of their noses and go nowhere. But I think that when people ask me, well, how do I set a goal? Well, first of all, push your horizons to infinity. There's nothing you can't do. Sit down and write down just what you want to do, or don't worry about position, money, or anything else, and get that list, and then see what's feasible. And you might start off small and gradually grow bigger and bigger, and it's things can be done. It depends. I think from an early age, I discovered the secret, without really even knowing that I was discovering, I discovered the secret of going after what I wanted and not being hogtied, so to speak, by other people's opinion. Oh, you can't do that. Or you're too this. For instance, when I became a discus thrower, I'm only 5'3" tall. Well, whoever heard of a 5'3" discus thrower throwing a discus over 200 feet? I was one of the best discus throwers in the world at that time. But, and I don't say that because I'm lauding myself as a great athlete, I was just determined to do something that I wanted to do. And so I'm 5'3" tall. Well, I'll fix that. I'll just train harder than anybody else, and I'll be a better technician than anybody else. So that's what I did, and that's how I was able to, found success. Mm-hmm. And it can be done. You, I could have limited myself and said, oh, no, I can't do that. People are right. I'm only 5 foot three tall. But I said, no, the event fascinates me. It's what I want to do. And so I did it.
What led you to the luge?
Oh, that was interesting. One day I completed what I wanted, you know, all my goals in discus throwing. And one day my husband and I were watching television. We saw luge and we thought, well, that's quite fascinating. Let's go try that. That's something we could do. And so he made the United States team. I made the U.S. and he made the men's team. I made the women's team for the U.S. And then I won the United States National Championship. And that was another goal I set myself. I realized, well, you know, people told me, well, there's people been in this sport 10 years. If technique is great, you don't even know hardly one end of a sled to the other. So I said, I'll find out. And I'll use whatever natural abilities I have, and I'll get the job done. And then I gave myself 2 years to win the championship, and that's what I did. Again, not because I'm such a great athlete, but because I wanted to do something so badly, I did it.
Yeah. What was it like the first time in that sled?
Oh, my gosh, I thought I was going to die of fright. Then fright became part of my life, and I was okay.
Yeah. Well, speaking of fright, you've got to tell us about polar bears.
Oh, that's another fright. That was even worse than the luge sled.
I bet.
It's a terrifying thing to have to stand there with a polar bear 6 feet from you, and you're both staring into each other's eyes. And I knew very well that I was simply a menu on this animal's, just a meal on another item on this animal's menu. My job was to get off that menu as fast as I could, but things weren't moving very fast. And so I just stood there. I'd lived with the Inuit people for about a month before my expedition so that they could teach me how to survive with these polar bears, how to live with them and survive. And so I was remembering all that I'd been taught. My heart was pounding so loudly. I know that they could hear it miles away. And but I kept my calm. I didn't panic. That was the main thing. Don't panic. Remember what you've been taught, and just have the idea that it's going to be okay.
Yeah. Well, tell us about Charlie.
Oh, Charlie, of course. Now he's the star. I wrote a book when I came back from the expedition called Polar Dream, and, of course, naturally, Charlie is the star of the book. He was my polar bear dog. He's a Canadian Eskimo Husky. His grandfather was an Arctic wolf, and I bought him from the Inuit people. He was the best polar bear dog in the village. He kept the villagers safe from these animals. So he and I walked to the pole. He walked at my side and watched for polar bears, and he warned me when they came. And then when one would become aggressive and start to attack, Charlie would leap at the bear, grab a bear by its rear heel. Never go in the front because the bear would kill him. And he'd whip around the back very fast, about a 100-pound animal, very fast and very powerful. He'd grab the polar bear by the heel and hang on. And then the bear, of course, would forget all about me. And then finally he would tear away from Charlie because the bears are so powerful. Charlie would race across the ice chasing the bears, having wonderful bear chase. And I'd be surprised thinking, wow, I lived through that one thanks to Charlie. And so he was very important. Plus, I was the first human who had ever shown him any attention or any love at all. And we bonded immediately. Yeah. He didn't have a name when I met him, and I called him Charlie, and we were best buddies. And of course, I brought him home with me, and he lived to be 23 years old. He was just a fantastic fellow.
Yeah. He hadn't had a name until you came along. He was a working dog, and of course, with you, he was a working dog as well.
Yes, he was a working dog. His job was to watch for polar bears and help protect me, but we were best buddies. He wasn't supposed to sleep in the tent so he could watch for polar bears, but he was in the sleeping in my tent, not only in the tent but on my sleeping bag.
It's amazing the bond that we can have with dogs, cats, horses, our companion animals.
It's very, very special. You can become, in fact, I'm writing Charlie's biography now, and I think I'll just call the book Charlie. Because so many people, he has such a big fan club, but the bonding is amazing, and the reward from that bonding is just amazing. And we just recently rescued three beagle dogs, and dogs that have no hope, no homes. They need homes, and so we have some acreage, and we rescue a lot of animals. We've got all sorts of animals: goats and alpacas, sheep and dogs and cats, all rescued. And It's a very rewarding. It's just so good to know you're giving an animal a home. And of course, I brought Charlie home, and we live in the Cascade Mountains, and he loved the mountains. We hiked hundreds of miles. My husband Bill and Charlie and I, we hiked hundreds of miles. Of course, Charlie was also responsible for Bill and my husband and I studying wolves.
Yeah.
We lived alongside a wild wolf den just above the Arctic Circle in the Canadian Yukon. And the reason we could do that was because Charlie, you might say, spoke wolf. His grandfather was a wolf, and Charlie was raised with wolves in the Arctic. I watched him play with young wolves out on the ice after my expedition. And he, to make a long story short, he actually bonded with the wolf pack, and we became Charlie's pack. He became our alpha male, and the alpha male of the wild pack accepted him. And so we were able to live with wolves for a whole year, and I wrote a book called Three Among the Wolves. And, of course, as you can guess, Charlie was the star of that book as well.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is explorer Helen Thayer. She was named in 2002. The National Geographic Society named her one of the greatest explorers of the 20th century. As we've mentioned, she is the author of Polar Dream, Three Among the Wolves, and the forthcoming Walking the Gobi. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. What insights did you glean from those 6 months living very near a wolf den in the Arctic Circle?
Well, we actually were a year. We lived 6 months with a summer pack.
Okay.
And then we were with two more packs all winter, so it was actually a year.
Yeah.
The lessons we gleaned was that if only we humans could live the life of wolves, I don't mean so much the hunting, but the family life. They're very closely connected. They have a very strong family bond. The strict discipline within the family. The entire family raise the pups of the year. And they are very attentive to. We saw one animal of the summer pack came back injured after a wolf, after a moose hunt. These animals are very large and sometimes injure wolves when they hunt them. And the rest of the family licked the wound and cared for that animal, brought food to him for about 2 weeks until he was able to fend for himself again. But they really took care of him. He didn't miss a meal, that was for sure.
Hmm. As you've traveled over the years, have you seen significant changes in the environment?
Oh, especially in the north, we see the effects of global warming is really quite frightening because you see it in so many ways. For instance, native communities on the coast are having to move back because the water level is rising, and the ice off the coast in the far north is receding and getting thinner, which allows so that when there's a storm, it allows the waves to come up onto the shore, which makes another problem. And then buildings are tilting because the permafrost is melting. Roads are crumbling and buckling because of melting permafrost. And it's very strange, but we see now, I live here in northern Washington State, and the trees that we see here are slowly moving north. As the north warms, then the trees, flora from the southern areas moves north. It's able to grow in the warmer temperatures. And so we see the change in the various types of vegetation in the north now.
Hmm. What would you like to see happen so as to better protect the world's wild places?
Well, we'd certainly like to see people and animals get along better. It really saddens us to see the humans, we've moved in on other animals' territories, all sorts of animals, the elephants, monkeys, there's the latest talk about baboons in South Africa. People are living in their area, and then they wonder why the baboons are moving into their houses. This is where the baboons used to live, and and have done until recently. But we move into animals' territory, then we expect them just to pack up and go away. And they don't know anything about that. They've used generations of them have lived in that area. And there's the poaching that goes on all over the world. If people would stop buying ivory and animal parts, then there would be no business for the poachers to go out there and kill these animals. They'll kill an elephant, take its tusks, and leave the carcass just to rot in the sun. Mm. A total waste. And of course, that upsets family structures within the animal communities. So animals, we're very concerned about that, but we're also concerned about just the pollution that's going on. There's a lot of pollution in the Arctic even now, in the Antarctic.
And that is a real threat to polar bears. We hear about global warming in the polar bears,
yes.
But also pollution is a real threat.
It is, because even though you look at the ice pack, it's white, and you think, oh, that's so very white, but smallest amount of pollution that lands on the surface darkens it. We can't actually see the amount with the human eye to the amount that it is darkened. But any difference in shading draws more heat from the sun, and that increases the melting. And of course, these poor polar bears, they're really bad. They could start becoming extinct within our lifetime, because they need an ice platform to hunt from. They don't hunt on the land like the grizzlies and the black bears. They have to have an ice platform to hunt seals that live in the ocean. And without that platform, they're lost. In fact, there are polar bears now drowning because they have to swim so far to go hunt seals. Mm-hmm. And they're very powerful swimmers, but they do have a limit.
Yeah. What's the situation for other species? Seals, Arctic foxes, caribou, owls?
Well, they're all intertwined with the cold of the north. For instance, the snowy owl, he's colored white in the winter time because he's in a snowy environment. He hunts small animals that live in the cold environment. Now, if those small animals are not able to live in a warmer climate, well, then the snowy owl has nothing to eat, so he'll go away. The polar bears, well, if they can't hunt seals, then they'll go away. And then the seals, are they going to want to live in warmer waters? Can they live in warmer waters? So the whole system starts going downhill. Just one species after another starts feeling the effects of the warming trend that they're not adapted to. And because it's happening so fast, these species of animals are unable to adapt with the changing climate, because it's happening so fast.
Mm. How are fish stocks doing?
Well, fish, of course, in our area in Washington, the salmon is sadly depleted. A lot of it's due to logging, and the resulting erosion sends silt down into the rivers. There's also a certain amount of chemical pollution that they try to control, but it's impossible. And then we hear about so much mercury in fish now. Fish that we used to, shellfish, for instance. I was talking to a biologist the other day, and he specializes in shellfish, and he said he wouldn't eat any fish. He doesn't eat them anymore because of the incidence of mercury in them.
Hmm. What kind of choices do you and your husband Bill make in terms of being better consumers, and I mean better in terms of being more mindful of the impact that you have as consumers on the environment?
Well, on our expeditions, we always walk. We don't use vehicles. We walk everywhere, which is certainly a back to basics concept. There are expeditions crossing deserts and so forth. They just drive a four-wheel drive vehicle across. They leave tracks. They make dust. They disturb animals. They leave trash. Whereas we bring all of our garbage out, and we walk, and we try to leave. Even so, we do leave our footprints, but they certainly are minimal compared to a vehicle.
Yeah. This has always been something that I've felt kind of confused about. I mean, if you can pack it in, why can't you pack it out?
That's what we always wonder. We wonder that on the trails, even in these beautiful Cascade Mountains. We have a very rugged mountains here in Washington State. They're absolutely gorgeous mountains. They're tree-covered, and then higher up there are glaciers and snowfields. But even on the trails, sometimes we'll see people have just dropped their garbage, and so we take a little bag with us, and we pick it up. And so we find ourselves, as we hike, we're picking up after other people, and we wonder, if we can do it, why can't they do it?
Yeah, I don't for the life of me understand why the Himalayas, for example, are littered with so much junk.
Oh, Mount Everest is a disgrace.
Yeah.
It's absolutely a disgrace to the human race. What's happened there is the base camp is human waste, and there's cans of opened and unopened everywhere, and it's indescribable.
Why do you think that's the attitude? I mean, here you have a beautiful place, and you have to be very aware of your surroundings and how beautiful and how fragile it is. Why has this attitude come to be that you can just dump it?
Well, I think there are a lot of very concerned people out there. We know a lot of very, very concerned people who clear trails and pick up garbage and talk to people about picking up after themselves and so forth. So we know there's a large population who really do care and work very hard, but then there are a lot of people who just, they don't seem to care. And it's very hard to understand that. But in this modern day and age, there is a certain amount of, a mental attitude where it's I, me, and myself. I could go do what I want to do, and doesn't matter about anything else as long as I get what I want. That's why there's a lot of garbage left on Mount Everest, is because now for $65,000 you can get a guide to take you to the summit. They'll get you up there somehow, even if they have to half carry you. And they leave oxygen bottles all the way up the mountain, and they put tents up at various camps on the way up. They don't take anything down on the way home. They don't take it back with them. They just leave it there, a lot of them. Not all of them, of course, but a large number do. They have ropes on the mountain, fixed ropes, and there's even aluminum ladders that are permanently placed so you can climb the mountain a little easier. And while that doesn't apply to everyone, there certainly is a large number of people that they don't care. All they want to do is get to the summit.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, I'm not seeing beyond my own nose either, because I could do more, in my own little backyard to walk a little bit more gently on the planet. Maybe before we run out of time, we could talk about another woman explorer in this book, Women Explorers in the Women to Dare series. And I think this woman would be someone who you would who you would be fond of, and her name was Alexandra David Neal.
Oh yes,
1868 to 1969.
Yes, she had to be an extraordinary individual. I think I would have liked to have gone with her. she went when it was a forbidden territory, and Lhasa, the capital of Tibet, was the forbidden city. But to get in there, she blackened her face. To disguise herself, she blackened her face, and she took yak hair and turned it into braids, hair braids, so that she could add them to her hair to make her hair long. And of course, she wore the local costume. And then she went, and she traveled in Tibet. She met the Dalai Lama, and she did some extraordinary things, but also dangerous, because if she'd been caught, she would have been thrown out without any ceremony whatsoever, and maybe even harmed. And so she was very brave, a very determined woman, obviously.
Yeah. What do we know about her meeting with the Dalai Lama?
Well, apparently it was the first, I believe she might have been the first, I think she was the first Westerner to meet the Dalai Lama. And from what I understand, it had a profound effect on her life. Of course, it's a Buddhist area, religion and beliefs, and I think that she turned to Buddhism as a result of meeting him. She was so impressed with him.
And like you, she had a wonderfully supportive husband.
Yes, yes. Yep, she really did. He basically, he stayed home, and he sent the money, and she went off and did the journeys. One thing, I've done some solo journeys, of which my husband has supported, but he's also gone with me too. We both walked across the Gobi Desert, and 4 years after I walked to the magnetic North Pole, he and I walked to the pole, the same route, and unresupplied, pulling our own sleds the same way as I did, to celebrate our 30th anniversary.
How did the two of you meet?
My parents were farmers in New Zealand, and my husband was transferred from the United States to New Zealand as a pilot. He wasn't in the military, he was a commercial pilot in agriculture work. And he was sent to our farm to spray a very bad weed that was affecting the grasslands. And so we met there, and then we knew each other 2 years, and we were married in New Zealand, and then we were transferred to Guatemala and Honduras, where he flew, and we lived there for about 4 years. Then we moved to the United States.
Mm. When will you leave for Tibet? Because next year, the two of you are planning to walk across Tibet, Bhutan,
yes,
and Sikkim.
We're planning to leave in the spring after the worst of the winter is over. Because we'll be between 12 and 16,000 feet most of the time. And winters can be very, very severe, of course, at those altitudes. And so we'll be beginning in about probably early spring, and walking and living with the local people, resupplying ourselves with the local food, just as we did in the Gobi, mm-hmm. and just sort of living off the land and with the people, learning about them and learning about their customs and their thoughts and so forth, and seeing, you know, learning about their history and also where are they going in the future.
Yeah. So you're ready for some yak butter tea?
Yes. We'll have to get used to that. We always seem to be challenging our Western stomachs with some unusual fare, but that's part of it. And, of course, we bring all of the information back for Adventure Classroom.
Yeah. Now, what are your goals for this particular expedition?
We want to learn as much about the culture. We want to document this disappearing culture through photography and writing. We're both professional photographers, and I'm a writer. And we want to document this culture because they are disappearing. China has taken over Tibet and is becoming the predominant, very quickly becoming the predominant culture, and the Tibetan culture is disappearing and will be gone completely within a few years. And so we need to document it for the sake of history so that the kids of today and the kids of the future can, even though the Tibetan culture might be gone physically, it will still exist in Adventure Classroom. We'll have that on a website with the photographs and narration text, a background of native music and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. When you return from an adventure, an expedition, how do you settle back into the day-to-day?
Oh, that's one of the hardest things we do, because when we're away on those expeditions, we don't hear any negative news. You know, everything is positive. You might be trying to survive. You might be fighting for your life now and again, but it's all positive. But when we come home, there is all the negative news from all different sources. And we realize how negative society is and how sad and how depressed people very often are, even to some degree. It might not be a lot, but to some degree. And it's society, our society is so wrapped up in material things and racing about it at enormous speed and getting everything 20 things done in an hour, when somebody else might only get one done in a day. It's just a tremendous stress. You realize how stressed out our society is.
Yeah. Does going to your journals then and beginning writing, does that help?
Oh, yes. It's an excuse for me to relive the journey. I love it.
Yeah. When will Walking the Gobi be available?
It'll be available in October. Actually going through the last of the editing stages now and sorting through some photos, and so that will be Mountaineer's books are publishing it in October.
Okay, very good. It has been a pleasure to be able to talk with you this afternoon. I want to thank you so much for agreeing to spend some time with us this afternoon, Helen.
Well, thank you for having me.
Helen Thayer has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. In 2002, the National Geographic Society named her one of the greatest explorers of the 20th century. She's the author of Polar Dream, Three Among the Wolves, and the forthcoming Walking the Gobi. She's also one of the women featured in the new book, Women Explorers. It is in the Women Who Dare series from the Library of Congress, that book published by Pomegranate. And you'll find our guest, Helen Thayer, on the web at www.helenthayer.com. And that's T-H-A-Y-E-R.